Save big on everything when you shop at Menards. Upgrade your kitchen today with Clearview Cabinetry. We offer a great selection of finishes made with the finest materials and built to withstand life's sticky messes. They provide features like soft closed doors and drawers and with cabinet accessories to match your unique style. View our selection of Clearview Cabinetry on Menards.com. Plus, check out our weekly flyer and find plenty of great deals happening this week. Save big.
This is Hidden Killers Live with Tony Brewski, Stacy Cole, and Todd Michaels.
The Tepe murders is what we're going to be discussing here today. We're going to take a look at it from the prosecution side and the defense's side, both areas, based on where it's sitting right now. The unsealed affidavit in the Tepe murder case reads like a prosecutor's dream. Surveillance footage allegedly placing the suspect at the victim's home 3 weeks before the killings. Witness statements about death threats spanning years, stolen license plates, a cell phone that went dark during the murder window, and a vehicle tracked arriving before and leaving after. But how strong is this case, really? What's the most damaging evidence? And where could it all fall apart? Eric Faddis, defense attorney, former prosecutor, is with us to help us break this part of the conversation down. Eric, let's start with the affidavit that was just unsealed in the Tepe case that lays out what prosecutors believe happened. Surveillance footage, witness statements about threats going back years, stolen license plates, cell phone data, vehicle tracking. You've read what's publicly available from a prosecutor's perspective. How strong is this case?
You know, it seems to be getting stronger with every public release that the prosecution is issuing in terms of their evidence. You know, these most recent developments, which show allegedly McKee at the residence 3 weeks or so before these gruesome murders, I think is terribly problematic for the defense. And you know, there's locational information, there's ballistics evidence. And so it's really all starting to mount against Mr. McKee.
How do you defend against any of that? I know that's a very broad question to just, how do you do this? But sitting back, how in the world do you defend? What were you doing there? This is your ex-wife.
Yeah, you know, you
have no kids together. What were you doing there?
Sure. So you got to inquire about the whereabouts of your client. You know, perhaps he says, hey, that wasn't me on that video. Well, then you say, hey, well, where were you? Were you with somebody? Can I talk to that person? You do that investigation. You scrutinize the ballistics. You scrutinize the forensics and you try to see where the weaknesses might lie.
And we'll get into all the defense here in just a bit. I want to stay in the prosecution right
now. Sorry
There's
about
a
that.
Lot in this affidavit. You've got alleged threats, the walkthrough of the property 3 weeks before the murders, which, again, that's an interesting one, is being interpreted several different ways based on the language that was used in the affidavit. Was he just on the property? Was he in the backyard? Was he on the porch? Did he go in the house? It leaves a lot up for interpretation as of right now, and I've seen it reported in many different ways. One place is saying he went into the house. Some say he's just in the backyard. You got the phone going dark, the vehicle tracked coming and going. If you're the lead prosecutor and you have to pick one piece of evidence to build your entire case around, do you do it on just one thing? I mean, it feels like you can build a lot of mountains here, and like one gets knocked down, here's the next mountain. There's a lot.
You know, I think if the prosecutor can definitively show that was McKee at the residence 3 weeks before the murders, I think that's terribly damning. What in the world would be a reason why he would be there? You know, what it reeks of is someone kind of casing the joint, someone planning, someone sort of calculating, hey, what moves do I have to make? What steps am I going to take in the very near future? And shortly thereafter, we have two people shot to death in that same home. So I think that prior visit is really critical.
He made three specific statements, and we've been talking about him. Everybody's talking about him. They're powerful. I mean, They are powerful, but they're alleged through friends of Monique. They're not coming. I mean, we don't have Monique here to tell us that this is what I was feeling or this is what I was saying. you don't really have any sort of incentive for friends to be making these sort of things up, but they are what they are. In a case like this, this is what you get. Those statements being that over the last 8 years or so, she's claimed that he had said to her during the marriage that he could, quote, kill her at any time, that he would find her and buy the house right next to her, and that, quote, she will always be his wife. Sounds like crazy things a very controlling person would say to their partner as they're slipping away, as they're getting away from them, or as they've already gotten away, to rattle them, to inject fear into their psyche. Are those sort of statements ones that are going to get in front of a jury when the person who heard them firsthand is dead?
That's going to be a real issue here, Tony, because, you know, we've got essentially not one level of hearsay, not two levels, but three levels of hearsay. It's an out-of-court statement from McKee. Yeah, go ahead.
It's powerful, but yeah, is it admissible?
You know, that's going to be a judgment call by the judge here because, like I said, there are those three levels of hearsay. It is an admission by a party opponent if McKee said it, so that takes care of that level. But then you have Monique saying it to a friend who then said it to law enforcement. However, if the defense at trial tries to impugn the credibility of Monique in some way to say she was lying or she was exaggerating or making things up, it could possibly come in what's called a prior consistent statement on behalf of Monique. And in that way, it could get in front of the jury and would sort of sidestep the confrontation clause. But there's so many serpentine analytical questions that arise in terms of whether it's admissible.
I mean, it feels like he's making these alleged threats that he could kill her at any time, and then she's dead. It's kind of like, I said it would happen, and it happened, allegedly. So to me, doesn't it just seem like he kind of, I'm sorry, I'm lost. And this, the affidavit just, it floors me. I have no words. I just don't have a lot to say about it because it's to me, it just proves that he did this. Even though it's alleged, everything's alleged at this point. He was saying he was going to do this. I don't think she's going to sit there and make this shit up. She told her friends she was terrified.
Right. Yeah, that very well could be. I think defense is going to say, hey, prove that he said that. And the person to whom he said it is gone. You can't do that. You can't cross-examine that person.
Yeah, it's not like she died in a car accident. She died at the hands of a murderer.
Allegedly. Is there more weight to... you know, obviously she was murdered by a murderer. We don't know who that murderer is.
Correct.
Is there more weight to statements like this if they're coming from more than one person? If she told more than one person, if it's not just one friend coming in and saying, she told me specifically that he was going to buy the house next to her. If you have one person saying it versus you have five people that come forward and say it. I mean, granted, it's after the fact, everyone could corroborate their stories and they could all be like, yeah, well, we all heard something like this. But if all five can come forward and say, this is exactly what she said to me, does that put more weight in the mind of a judge if they're going to allow something like that to be admitted into a trial?
It definitely does, in part because most states have a hearsay exception for statements that just appear exceedingly reliable. And so it's kind of like a judge might look at it and say, yeah, that's hearsay, but there is so much support behind it that I think it is fair game to give to this jury. And if you've got five people instead of one, I think that sort of catch-all hearsay exception might be strongly considered by a judge.
What about the fact that, I mean, these are damning things, and this is always why people are, you know, they ask the question, well, why should I report these things? Nothing happens. It's just a piece of paper. And yeah, I get it. Totally get it. Because yeah, that piece of paper that says, you know, don't follow her, don't stalk her. I mean, it's a piece of paper. If someone's going to do it, they're going to do it. But it's on the record, at least.
Yeah.
It's there. It's there. So if you're in the situation where, let's say they were in a place where, oh God, there he is outside the house. Well, we already got it on record that he's been stalking us. Call 911. They're going to arrest him right then and there. It won't be a slap on the wrist of, why do you happen to be here right now? It's like, well, I lost my kitten. You know, a lot of things could be said, and then he could go on his merry way. Even more powerful now that they're dead and they're having to put these things into a trial format. If there has never been any sort of track record on the record of prior abuse, of making these sort of statements, of anything other than just within the social circles of Monique Tepe and her husband, it's not there. It's it's hearsay, essentially, is what it is. It's not on the record. Is that going to be difficult? Is that going to be an issue here as to why none of these things were on the record with law enforcement, especially when we're talking about that alleged prior visit to the house on December 6th? Again, no real record of that until after the fact. And even the visit itself is kind of sketchy in terms of what exactly was happening in that visit.
Right. You know, one general rule of mine that I advise clients on is, usually you should err on the side of making a report when it comes to harassment, stalking, threats, those kinds of things. Even if it doesn't result in a criminal prosecution or something, most police departments will at least take the report. It's documented. It's memorialized. It can be accessed later for reference and that kind of thing. You know, here we have some people who, you know, are friends and some things were said to different friends and that kind of thing. And that's a lot more loosey-goosey than if you have like a typed up police report from a police officer.
And one of the things that I've seen in our comment section is a lot of, and mainly for the most part, excuse me, women talking about how they're afraid to make that report because you've already got somebody who's stalking you. So now you're going to really piss them off by getting the, you know, authorities involved in it. So this speaks to, you need to get some of that on the record. You need to have that documented. As scary as it is, does it actually escalate somebody to do something further because you did report them?
Oh, it's an important point because after the report is made, in all likelihood, the police might go to this alleged perpetrator and say, hey, this lady's saying you're threatening her and stalking her and stuff like that. You know, what of it? And if no prosecution comes from that, the alleged perpetrator is going to be pretty ticked off. And so it's a balance. You got to kind of weigh that and ensure you're making the safest choice that you can under the circumstances, which is not always easy to glean.
It's possible she didn't want to report this because she knew she was going to be putting herself, pardon me, into jeopardy by doing so. Is that possible?
Sure. Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, yeah, I mean, if you're sitting there thinking that, you know, you say something about this to someone. No one ever, and the reality is no one's ever is going to see the equation come out this way of, oh, the authorities, again, just theoretically, let's go back to the December 6th alleged visit to the house that she knew something about. We don't know exactly what it was, but there was something that made her leave that game that day, according to friends, that she was upset about with her ex-husband. Happened to be the day that authorities say he was, you know, out there staking that the house, was at the house doing something when they were not there. You call the police, you say that, you know, they go visit him. What were you doing there? Blah, blah, blah. This, no one ever who's doing these sort of things is going to back off and be like, you got me, guys. You're right. That was really inappropriate. I should have been stalking my wife of 8 years ago, hanging out on her porch or whatever the hell it was. No one's they're going to deny it. They're going to evade it. They're going to, you know, there's no like reasonable expectation that they're going to take that with consideration and go, I'm going to back off now. It's one of two things. They're either going to completely back off and just deny that it ever happened and hope to God they're not prosecuted further, or they're going to go further. And it appears he went further, but there was never that intervention, allegedly, at least as far as we know, no call to anyone. What's your take on that? On what, and this is just pure conjecture as we talk about the prosecution end of this, but what do you think happened at that game that made her leave, that she knew something about what was going on, and then that still no calls to authorities. What do you think is going on in the minds of her as a victim at that moment in time?
You know, I've talked, Tony, with many victims of domestic violence, especially when I was a prosecutor.
Yeah.
And fear is truly front of mind. And then also sort of this hope, perhaps a misplaced hope, that this is all going to blow over. This guy's going to get over it. He's going to move on with his life. He's going to stop bugging me. I've got a new family. God, I just hope that this, you know, just progresses in that fashion. And sadly, it often doesn't. Stalking is a huge lethality factor in the domestic violence context. As prosecutors, we were told to look for that. And it's not something that usually, you know, de-escalates in some incremental way. It usually gets worse.
Yeah, it doesn't de-escalate. It does usually just get worse. I mean, I can't think of any cases where it's like, oh, they were called out and then they slowed that down a little bit.
No.
It's always just up. And it's because the person who's stalking doesn't see it as the rest of us see it for what it is. Stalking. They see it as something more twisted in their cognitive distortion of reality, which enables them to do whatever the hell it is they're doing, which obviously led to allegedly what happened here. Let's go to the other angle of this. Michael McKee has pled not guilty. He's sitting in the Franklin County Jail without bond, facing two counts of aggravated murder, aggravated burglary, and firearm specifications. His defense team now has to look at everything in that unsealed affidavit and figure out what they can challenge, what they can exclude, and how to create reasonable doubt in a case where the court of public opinion has already convicted their client. Eric Faddis, defense attorney, former prosecutor. Obviously, you've been on both sides of this. You know what prosecutors are planning and know how to defend something like this, too. I mean, to the best extent that one possibly could, and that's what oftentimes a defense attorney has to do. Go in and deal with the cards you are dealt. Eric, McKee has pled not guilty and has waived his bail hearing, reserving the right to address bail at a later date. For people watching who don't understand the strategy here, what is the strategy here? Why waive the bail hearing when you're sitting in jail? What does that tell you about how the defense is approaching this case in the early stages?
You know, I'm wondering if perhaps they want to let things cool off a bit. You know, this thing is so in the public eye and there are all these national reports, perhaps sort of letting it die down, letting the temperature go down a little bit. Perhaps they think that might increase their chances of a better ruling, you know, 3 weeks or a month from now, as opposed to now. But that being said, it is a bit of a head scratcher because most defendants who are in custody want to get out immediately. That's not the case for Mr. McKee.
Yeah, that's this is not a good one. This is not one that I think a lot of defense attorneys are going to be super excited to get behind. But he's hired one. He's hired an expensive one, too. One that certainly has her reps in defending high profile cases, defending doctors. Malpractice suit got a doctor off recently. Charged with 14 counts of murder for fentanyl overdoses, and he walked free. So she's got some reps here. She knows how to do this. This is a very different case, though, obviously. When we go back to all of those things that we're hearing, those damning statements from friends of Monique, things that she said, what, as a defense attorney, what is she going to be looking for, as this is obviously going to be something that's going to be litigated and argued for admissibility into a potential trial here? What are the things she is going to be going to the judge with and saying, these can't come into trial, and here is why, other than just it's hearsay and it's from one person to another?
Yeah, you know, I think part of the strategy on defense in a case like this is to try and chip away at the alleged evidence and try to get pretrial rulings that it's going to be inadmissible. So these statements, you know, there is the hearsay issue. There's also the constitutional confrontation clause issue, such that, you know, as a general rule, statements against the defendant cannot be admitted into court unless the declarant, the person who's saying the defendant said that, is there. We don't have that here. So there's a chance they're going to chip away at those statements. On top of that, the ballistics and the firearm that was found, the reports I've read have said that they believe the firearm they found at McKee's residence is similar to the firearm that police believe was used in this crime. That's not conclusive.
No.
And ballistics can be challenged. You know, I think that chipping away process is probably happening as we speak.
Is there any way that he walks?
Oh, gosh. I mean, you know,
there's always a way.
I know there's always a way, but my gut is like, this seems like a really dangerous person. If he did these crimes, he is terrifying to have on the streets.
Very true. But perhaps, you know, his attorneys, I'm sure, are doing extensive interviews regarding whether he had an alibi. You know, I know mm-hmm. some people think it looks like him on those videos, but is that for sure him? That's still an open question.
Let's talk about his phone, because he thought if it's him, he thought he was like outsmarting everybody by leaving it at his office, at the doctor's, at his doctor's office in Rockford at the hospital for 17 hours, while someone was out doing this. Just happens to be that time that his phone's at a hospital, you know, not really a track record of doing this as far as we know. So it's kind of an outlier. You know, Koberger, we saw, you know, he turned the phone off. People seem to think they're being real tricky when doing this, this sort of thing. Obviously, it's better than seeing the GPS going all the way to her house and going all the way back. But he's, you know, the car's caught on camera. It's his car. It's pretty clear it's his car. There's even a sticker that was caught on some of the cameras that was a fairly identifiable mark on the vehicle. And the vehicle now in possession shows where that sticker was. And it's been obviously scraped off. Somebody, he saw it, or somebody saw it and went, ooh, kind of identifiable. Maybe I should get rid of it. But it wasn't very good the way they scraped it off. You can tell there was a sticker there. I mean, there's all these little things that he clearly was telling himself with, if I do this, I'll get away with it. They won't catch me. Those often turns out to be like really almost more telling of a mindset than not. How do you think that's going to play? The whole phone thing being turned off and left at the hospital for those 17 hours.
Yeah, you know, one way that it could be interpreted is as concealment, as a person who's trying to hide what they're doing, who knows that, hey, if I bring my phone and it's on, it's going to show my location. So, oh, let me be super sneaky and just leave this at my work. But like you sort of alluded to, Tony, if that is a gross departure from his normal practices, that's going to be a problem. If the prosecution interviews his coworkers, his friends, people in his life, and they're like, hey, does he just like randomly leave his phone at work for like a whole day? Is that something he does? And they'd be like, no, I've never seen him do that. That's going to show, hey, what was the explanation for why he engaged in such a behavioral departure from what he usually does? Was it that he was out going killing these two people?
Do you think it was reconnaissance that he showed up there in December 6th for the early visit? I question if this was his only first visit. I do wonder if he was there a lot of other times and we just don't know about it yet. But let's say it was, you know, it was the only time he's been there other than the 30th. Do you think it was reconnaissance to get to know the house, to get to know where the place was? Or do you think he just showed up and they weren't home and he wasn't able to follow through that day and it ended up being December 30th instead?
Gosh, you know, an ominous inquiry there. It's hard to say, but certainly it would be consistent with you know, other criminals who like case the joint, who you know, learn the layout of the topography of this area, of the neighborhood, everything else. Learn, you know, where the doors are, what doors might appear to have access, what windows might appear to have access. Where am I going to go if I get into this house? What am I? How am I going to plan this out? That's typically what that kind of a prior visit might indicate. Or was that going to be the fateful day? An even darker consideration.
They say there was no forced entry into the Tepe house. To me, this isn't like a big deal. Maybe it is. Help me understand this better. People leave their doors unlocked all the time. Maybe that's all that happened, but I could see the prosecution trying to argue that means that the victims either knew their killer, or the killer had sophisticated access. It either could have just been they opened the door and it was unlocked. What do you make of the fact that there wasn't the breaking of the door down or some sort of forced entry into the home? Is that a point that matters here to the defense, to the prosecution? Is that going to be a point? And is that a point where the defense could go down another road with it? Let's just start there with it. Is it a point? Is it anything other than the door is unlocked?
Well, Tony, as you said, as defense counsel, especially in a case where there appears to be substantial damning evidence, you have to play the hand you're dealt. And so this is a card in that hand. And so defense is going to look at that and say, hey, could that mean that someone who actually knew the Tepe family, who was invited into the home, who had access, who had a key, something like that, a neighbor, a friend, a coworker, family member, who knows, does it give rise to a potential alternative suspect? Or at least, is it evidence consistent with an alternative suspect either being let in or having access to the house and then committed these murders when it was not defendant McKee? That's the way defense might look at it.
So they're planting the seed of doubt.
Sure. Yeah, they got to play the hand they're dealt. And that's one way to play this otherwise somewhat crummy hand.
We've seen no evidence of this yet. This is just 1,000% pure conjecture. And there's obviously... we haven't seen anything of it because they probably don't even know of it yet. And maybe they do. Maybe it's in evidence. Maybe the digital footprint's going to be very interesting. If this is a big if, because we do not know anything about this, and I'm not basing this on any sort of anything. This is just coming from the ether of my brain. If we find that there was some sort of communication between Monique and McKee over these 8 years, and I'm not saying it in any sort of way of like leading him on or
yeah,
anything of that nature. I'm not
blaming.
I'm not going down that. I'm just saying anything of just, kind of keeping him at bay. Messages like that. Just,
And he's taking it as a breadcrumb.
Yeah. That's kind of what I'm wondering about. Does it, I'm saying if there is communication, obviously it'll depend what it is, but if there is any sort of communication, minimal at best, let's say that is, there's just minimal breadcrumbs like that, does that play well for McKee, or does that hurt McKee in the end in something like this, if there's anything?
In my appraisal, it hurts them, and that could be regardless of the content of those communications. And what I mean is that a big question when this case started was, what's this guy's motive? Why would he care about some person from whom he was divorced like 9 years ago? It's been so attenuated. People move on with their lives. Well, this answers that question. This communication, if it exists, is bridges that temporal link to say, hey, actually, Monique was on McKee's mind, and. For years after this, it goes to motive, and it shows that he is still kept in contact with her, was thinking about her, and that sort of answers the question of why, how could a person who divorced 9 years ago still be involved in this? Well, these communications, if they exist, allegedly show that involvement.
Are you surprised by the sloppy nature of this? I mean, there are certain pieces to this that are very rigid and very specific as to how things were done if he did this, but there's also just sloppiness. The overlooking that, there's Ring cameras everywhere, that there's security cameras everywhere you go, that you're going to be tracked, that changing your license plate isn't going to work like it did 30 years ago, that leaving your phone somewhere isn't really going to do that. It's going to look more suspicious. Does this read to you as something that was well thought out and well planned for 8 years? Or does this read to you more like I'm angry and I'm going to be completely running on adrenaline here as I go and do this sort of thing? I don't know, because I'm surprised by the amount of F-ups that we're seeing in this alleged plot, if in fact it's created by this person who, you know, genuinely does have some intelligence to him, but maybe just not so much in terms of socially or how the world works.
To me, it strikes me, Tony, as kind of an amateur criminal smart guy. So he's got intelligence. He's a doctor. And perhaps he thought he was smarter than he really is. I'm not aware of any criminal history for this gentleman that's been publicly disclosed. And so someone who's not, you know, in this world, that they're not a professional assassin or something, they think, hey, I'm a pretty smart dude. I can navigate this and get away with it. They often overlook these what might be glaringly obvious signs and indications that they could be caught. Sometimes they don't think about it. Sometimes they think, I've taken other precautions that are going to protect me or whatever. But it kind of strikes me as someone who thought they were smarter than they really were, but were truly kind of a novice when it comes to criminality.
What about the end game here? If the defense looks at this case and decides they probably can't win an outright acquittal, too much evidence, too much publicity. There's a lot of it here, obviously. Mm-hmm. What is the fallback? Is there a lesser path here, lesser charges that might be a win? Could this go from aggravated murder to manslaughter through negotiation? Obviously, the death penalty, technically, it could be on the table. It does exist in the state, but it hasn't been used forever. So maybe probably isn't going to really be a thing. So trying to get that off the table, not necessarily the end goal here. What do you do? I mean, is there any other avenue here that you can go down when you have this level of evidence that's going against you? And we know how it's going to read in court, no matter how you try and spin it. Is there an insanity defense? I mean, I think that's one hell of a bridge to try and get that far on, considering what it looks like the amount of premeditation. But I don't know. I mean, is there any other road you can see this going other than it's just... it's going to be a train wreck that attorney's going to, you know, really be interesting to watch to see what they present in court. But at the end of the day, it is what it is. And even the best attorneys, they can come up against a brick wall.
Oh, yeah. I mean, defense has to explore alibi, whether they can prove that McKee was somewhere else with someone else. They've got to explore possible alternative suspects and say, hey, who could possibly have a motive and the opportunity to do this? They've got to look at possible not guilty by reason of insanity. I haven't seen any significant evidence of that. But if they hit a brick wall, you know, typically they would try to sort of posture for some sort of lesser offense with some sort of cap on the amount of prison time that isn't life without the possibility of parole. Because if you get a cap on it, you get a number of years, sometimes that number goes down with good time, with earned time, with things that happen at the facilities, with rehabilitation. You look at that, but I think the kicker here, Tony, is that there were two deaths. If there was one death, I think it would be a lot more likely that they might be able to get some kind of leniency, even if it was a modicum of leniency. With two deaths, it's going to be a stretch.
Yeah. Yeah, it's going to be a wild ride to watch. Let's move over to another case that we've been talking about for quite some time. Corey Richens, 2 weeks before Corey faces a jury on aggravated murder charges, her defense team dropped a bombshell motion alleging prosecutors are intimidating witnesses, including threats of arrest and the revocation of immunity. This comes on top of the October revelation that the state's key fentanyl sourcing witness also recanted, claiming he never sold fentanyl to the housekeeper, allegedly in this drug chain. With pretrial rulings limiting the FBI profiler's testimony, excluding domestic violence evidence, and the admissibility of the walk the dog letter still partially unresolved, this case is going to trial with both sides wounded. Former prosecutor and defense attorney Eric Faddis has followed the case closely with us and going to give us an interesting perspective on it, because you can see see both sides here. We got 2 weeks before trial. Corey Richens' attorney filing this motion claiming lead detective Jeff O'Driscoll texted a witness saying essentially, answer our call so we can prep you, or the next time I knock on your door, I'll have a warrant and a catch pole for your dog. As a former prosecutor, when you read something like that in a court filing, what's your gut reaction? Is this aggressive law enforcement, or does it cross into witness intimidation territory?
It's certainly needlessly aggressive. It doesn't need to be like that. You know, as the prosecutor, you want to be the one wearing the white hats and riding the white horse and being pure and moral, and you're trying to do the righteous and just thing for these victims. But when you have somebody on your side who's, you know, potentially crossing a line in terms of messing with witnesses, scaring them, intimidating them, that does damage to this impression that you're trying to give the jury as this upstanding prosecution team. It's a team. And especially if that's the lead detective, the jury might look at that dude with a side eye and say, you know, what other lines has he possibly crossed in this investigation?
The same motion alleges the prosecution's lead investigator, Travis Hooper, told a second witness that their previously granted immunity remains conditional upon continued cooperation. And it very well might, whether that witness wants to accept that or not. And that declining further meetings could put that immunity at risk. That's not a crazy concept. That is how a lot of this does work, even if you decide further down the road, I don't want to do that anymore. It's more so now we're looking at kind of the means by which one is then being compelled to give this said testimony for that immunity. From your experience in both sides of the aisle, how often do you see immunity wielded in this way? And does that kind of language constitute an actual threat under Utah law, or is it just hardball tactics to get somebody to come into court that is, you know, maybe a little bit too harsh? Maybe the verbiage needs to be toned down a bit. You could get the same message across a different way.
You know, this one, I really don't take issue with. This is actually pretty standard. When it comes to an immunity agreement, the general idea is that, hey, bro, we're going to keep you out of prison and protect you, and you're not going to be charged for the cooperation you give. You got to give that cooperation. And it's not just one interview. It's not just one meeting. It's cooperation throughout the entire pendency of the case, including during trial and giving trial testimony, and not only being cooperative, but being truthful. If the individual is inaccurate or inconsistent in some way, that can result in a revocation of immunity. And so this one actually seems pretty standard to me. I think defense is sort of overblowing it and trying to conflate this immunity issue with this prior alleged witness intimidation or harsh tactics, however you want to call it.
As a layperson, it feels that way.
Is it like where they were like do they have a Joker in their hand and it's Joker Wild and they're like, we can do anything we want right now? Like, and they're playing it for like every inch they can get to make this look really, really bad out there. Because again, you're going for reasonable doubt. That's all you're going for here. And yeah, you know, if you can make the process look corrupt, if you can make the process look rough, where it's uncomfortable and people are being compelled to say things that maybe they otherwise wouldn't say, that can create reasonable doubt in a juror's mind. I'm wondering if that's what's going on right here. The defense is now demanding all communications between prosecutors, investigators, and witnesses in this case. If the judge grants that motion, how damaging could it potentially be for the state, not just legally, but in terms of credibility with the jury before opening statements even begin, especially if the prosecutors have been playing rather hardball, if they're talking to the witnesses in non-snowflakey terms, if they're talking to them pretty direct, pretty rude, pretty, here's, you know, you do this or this is going to happen. I mean, we already have the one where it's basically threatening, we're going to take your dog if you don't cooperate.
Very Wizard of Oz-like, isn't it?
It's like, yeah, you need to cooperate, but seems to be almost crossing a line of like, we're going to, you know, take your dog and take him to the pound and God knows what else that's insinuating there. Is that a bridge too far? I mean, it has nothing to do with the actual murder case or the charges against Corey Richens. But if you can create this chaos over here, like we saw in another case, the Barry Morphew case, that whole thing got destroyed because the prosecution was out of their mind the way they were handling it so sloppily. I think it was in Colorado, wasn't it?
It was indeed, yes.
Yeah. So, I mean, they got disbarred because of it. And now Barry's, you know, all it's been a little bit of time, but it's just drug it out even further. The state ended up, filing charges again, and they're going to try him again. But these sort of things can really derail a trial. What do you think we're going to see here if the judge grants that motion to have all of those communications revealed? Is that even a realistic possibility this close to a trial to expect that sort of transparency of private communications be revealed to a defense attorney?
You know, defense is arguing that, hey, based on the nature of this alleged improper influence from law enforcement onto witnesses, we need to know what they were telling them. We need to know if they were twisting their arm, if they were suggesting things, if they were insinuating, hey, maybe say this. Hey, maybe don't say this. You know, when I was a prosecutor, I would say, hey, the number one golden rule when I'm prepping a witness, tell the truth. Just get up there and tell the truth. That's all we need. The truth is going to bring it home for us. But when you have the opposite impression to the jury of some sort of puppet master behind the scenes who's corralling these witnesses, influencing them, possibly intimidating them to give testimony that aligns with the government's case, I think a jury might look at that and say, gosh, I can't place faith in any of these witnesses who are prepped by the government because I have such a doubt in my mind as to whether it was done properly and what influence may have been exerted.
Yeah, I mean, if you have a strong case, if the government's case against Corey Richin is as strong as they like to pretend it is, why would you need to be doing this or saying these things to these witnesses? I mean, look, there's people don't want to go to court. People don't want to take time out of their day to go and testify or have attention on them for, you know, maybe somewhat embarrassing, shady moments in their own life. I'll talk about Robert Crozier here. He recanted his testimony from October. He originally told investigators that he sold fentanyl to the housekeeper who then allegedly supplied Corey Richin's. Now he says it was Oxy, not fentanyl, and that he was detoxing and he was out of it during the original interview. The defense says this eviscerates the prosecution's sourcing theory. I mean, does it? You know, or can the state pivot mid-trial without destroying his credibility? Or was it on shaky ground to begin with, but the prosecution really wants that original version, all the other nuances to that be damned. You're going to say what I told you to say and say what you said back then, even though you've said this is kind of why you said it that way. Or we're going to take your dog. I mean, it's a little much. Yeah.
You know, I can't help but wonder if the prosecution is starting to shake in their boots a little bit. They're starting to see the writing on the wall of how this could look at trial. And then sometimes, you know, Tony, in these law enforcement communities and prosecutors' offices, you've got some outstanding folks. And you've got some not so outstanding folks. You've got people with egos. You've got people who want to win. You got people who might push the envelope, who might take it too far in order to try and win. And that's what the defense will seize on. And they will say, hey, this central witness, this key witness, completely contradicted themselves on a critical point here. And then the prosecution sort of later on is trying to do damage control by influencing these other witnesses to say what they want them to say because they're trying to salvage their case, which now sucks. That's the argument I'm making to the jury, and I'm telegraphing that in opening statements.
It just feels like you're grasping for straws if you have to threaten taking somebody's dog. I mean, what did they say? Something about taking like a dog, one of those poles?
Use a pole. Yeah, they got to use the dog. I mean, showing up to your house with the pole, with the dog catching.
We use those in the vet field.
Just
those
are visual of that.
Yeah, it's horrifying. You don't want to do that. It would instill fear upon somebody, for sure.
It's either the work of someone who has zero anger management skills,
right?
and is not good at communicating what they want done and how to do it in an effective manner, which very well could be the case. There's, I'd say, a majority of the population. But when you're in that position, you'd hope for better, but you don't always get it. But with something like this, let's talk about some of the poisoning issues in this case. we have the story, and it is just that. There is no proof to these stories that Eric was allegedly attempted to be poisoned by a sandwich that Corey left for her husband in his vehicle one day, asked what he wanted to eat, dropped off his favorite sandwich. He said he felt violently ill afterwards, threw up, and then he told some friends he thought maybe she was trying to poison him. Or he had tainted ham. I don't know. I mean,
if he left
not,
it in the car.
Well, it's yeah, I mean, it's not beyond the realm of possibility that he got food poisoning and Corey had absolutely nothing to do with it. I mean, I think if we're going through the track record of any long-term relationship, we've probably poisoned our significant others a time or two through cooking, unintentionally, or from a restaurant we bought food from. Does it? I mean, again, because there's no toxicology here that says that sandwich had poison in it. There's no fentanyl that's ever been recovered either. No pills, no forensic link directly tying Corey to the drugs. The toxicology shows Eric Richens had 5 times a lethal dose in his system. The sourcing chain now has a critical witness saying he didn't sell what they said he sold. And look, people take fentanyl. Who's to say he was taking it and didn't tell his wife? There's a lot of possibilities here that aren't just she poisoned him with a ton of fentanyl. Yeah. We just don't know. I mean, and the other aspect of this, it doesn't sound like it was the happiest of relationships. It doesn't necessarily mean that then someone is going to poison another person to get out of the relationship. Sometimes when people are in unhappy relationships, they kill themselves. I'm not saying that that's what Eric was doing, but they also take drugs recreationally to try and numb that pain, numb that annoyance, numb that shitty relationship that they are currently enduring. And if you're taking fentanyl, and I don't know if he was or wasn't, but one could take a certain amount thinking I'll be fine with this, and then it didn't work out so well. I mean, these are all pieces of doubt, obviously, mm-hmm. that the defense is going to try and introduce into this case. How effectively do you think they can do it?
Well, I imagine the defense has made a motion to this effect or will by the time of trial. The judge needs to be very careful because when it comes to this prior alleged drugging, so there's a rule of evidence. It's usually 403 in most states, which indicates that if the probative value of a certain piece of evidence is substantially outweighed by the danger of unfair prejudice, by the danger of misleading the jury, confusing the issues, conflating the issues, then it should not be admitted. And this prior alleged drugging seems very shaky to me. There is no toxicology to prove it. There are no other witnesses that I'm aware of that could somehow corroborate or verify that there was a drugging that took place. It seems like it's just casting an immense amount of shade on Corey Richens with very little to back it up. And if the judge lets in that prior alleged drugging and there's a conviction, I think there is a substantial ground for appeal.
Wow.
The infamous walk the dog letter found in Corey's jail cell, allegedly instructing her mother how to lie on the stand. I mean, it's written in code, so one can take it however they want to take it. She's saying it was, you know, part of a novel or a screenplay or whatever the hell she was saying. It's saying it's anything but what the prosecution's saying it is. It's been partially admitted, but the judge is still deciding on portions of it. If you're the prosecution, how central is that letter to proving consciousness of guilt? And if you're the defense, how do you explain away what looks like a script for witness tampering?
Yeah, I mean, if I'm defense, I'm sort of riding the horse of there are all these paper thin inferences that the prosecution wants to sell you. That this prior alleged drugging for which there's no documentation, there's no criminal police report, there's no toxicology. There is this, you know, she's an author, she's an artist, she's a creative person. Create things, and sometimes they might be seen as a little wacky by somebody else. That does not mean that it is some kind of confession to a crime or attempt to influence a witness to protect themselves from a crime. Now, if you're prosecution, you're kind of saying, hey, this just seems par for the course. Look at that book she wrote, and then look at this letter, and then look at all of the incriminating, suspicious stuff that's going on. No indication this guy was suicidal that I'm aware of, that's publicly been reported. So add it up, guys. Use your common sense. So I think, you know, multiple interpretations of it.
And that's the truth. At the end of the day, it is about the interpretation of this. I mean, two things can be true at the same time. Corey could have been trying to communicate to her mom, please, you know, testify this way, say something this way. And it may have been, you know, it may not be on the up and up. It may be, you know, tampering with a witness potentially. But it may also be, look, if you say it this way, it's going to come across this way. People are going to take it this way. And that's not what reality is. So it needs to be delivered a certain way so people can truly understand what reality is. Otherwise, they're going to run with it that direction. Trying to curb others' perceptions of reality or what people are going to jump to conclusions with. It's a thing. It does exist, obviously. It exists in marketing. It exists in all aspects of our life. We don't want people running with something that's not accurate. So you're going to find ways sometimes of saying it one way, because saying it this one seemingly clear way, they're still going to take it another. So we got to do it this way. And you can't exactly just flat out say that when you're behind bars without someone catching on as to what you're saying. So could there be coded language that really doesn't necessarily hide a murder, just more so phrase it this way so people don't go down that road? I think that's a real possibility too. I don't know. The closer we get to this trial, the less damning it feels against Corey Richens.
Yeah,
I feel that way. And I don't know if just because this case has been screwed up 7 ways to Tuesday through bad investigative work or what, but I don't know. I don't know that they have enough to get her here. I really don't. What, I mean, at the end of the day, what's your gut telling you, Eric?
I'm kind of gravitating in that direction. And I wasn't always there. I think I was kind of like, yikes, this seems problematic. But yeah, and like you said, when it comes to the note, like think about a person who's wrongfully charged. You know, they're going to want to take measures to protect themselves, vindicate themselves. And if that measure might look like, hey, mom, like, you know, be careful about how you say something and maybe phrase it like this so that people don't further condemn me wrongfully. You know, that's a possibility.
Well, and mom, it's not like mom knows this process. I mean, so she's probably just trying to guide her a little bit, just like you said.
Yeah. And how many of us, I don't know, maybe in this room,
I know where you're going,
who have it, where you've had to have that conversation with your mom and you're not covering up a murder. You know, you're just like, hey, you know, when this person comes, don't bring this up. If you're going to talk about this.
Yes.
Approach it this way.
Yes.
Not because mom is out to like create World War III, but because she's ignorant. Because it's just how she communicates. And you'd rather it be delivered a certain way. Again, not because you're hiding anything, but because people are going to take it another way. And you're just trying to put some, you know, barriers up or put some, you know, padding on the walls for someone's candor. It's not it's not crazy. And it's not necessarily criminal either, but I guess that's what the jury is there to decide. Your thoughts in the comment section on our YouTube, just search Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi to find us there. Or you can join us on our Substack, hiddenkillers.substack.com. The link is in the description. We'd love to get your thoughts on the case right there. So go ahead and weigh in. We'll continue this conversation off the air in the comment section. Until next time, for Todd, Stacy, and Eric, I'm Tony Bruschi. We'll talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.